Your father operated the LeGrand Ironworks. Yeah. I imagine that you have pretty vivid images of what that looked like outside and inside.
Yeah, the buildings are still there, right over here.
Well, the original one is not.
Oh, no.
The original one is where the OTEC building is now.
Yeah.
Yes. What did the old one look like?
Well, I've got a picture of it out here, and we can go out and show you in the shed.
Is that the outside, though?
Well, yes and no. You can kind of, the one is an outside picture, and then I've got a picture of the inside.
Well, what kind of equipment did he have set up inside?
Well, primitive. It's very rudimentary. It was, I don't think there was any concrete floor, and it was just a building that was placed there to conduct whatever he was doing at that particular time. I don't ever remember that building as such, because it was before I was born that he moved down to the old building.
I misunderstood. I thought that you had been around when that old building was
I don't remember ever there, because by the time I came along, which was 1918, he had moved over to on Cove Avenue, and I don't really know how long he was there in that place on Elm Street. The streets weren't paved that long ago where the fire station is now, and not the new one, the old one, and that I don't ever remember the streets not being paved there. So that occurred early on when he was over at that old building.
Would you describe the inside of the new one then? The kinds of equipment that were there.
Well, yes, it was a very well equipped shop. He did lots of different kinds of work for different people. Anything. Well, you're picking all that up or not?
Sorry.
Goodbye.
But anyway, after he built a new shop, this was, as far as I know, was the buildings that they were there now. I know were there prior to 1918. The reason I know that, one of the old historians of the valley, Earl Van Blocklin, he called me one day, and this is since I've been out here in fairly recent times, he called and he wanted to know when those buildings were built. And I said, well, I thought sometime 1922, or something like that. The reason I was thinking along those lines, the buildings burned two different times. And so Van Blocklin said, well, I used to work on the farm that's out here, just past Town City. I worked on the farm during the summertime and everything, and I worked for your dad during the winter. And I said, how do you know that? Well, he says, you were born in December of 1918. I said, yeah, that's right. I said, what does that mean to you? He said, well, I was working for your dad. I think there were about 25 or 30 people worked there, crew. And he said, your dad came around just before Christmas handing out cigars, because you had been born on December 23rd, 1918. And he said, so that building was there then. I said, well, you know more about that at that point than I do. But at any rate, the various machinery, they had several lathes to turn steel on. As I remember, two or three lathes of one size and a couple of some other size. Then he had a wood turning shop, and he had people there that could turn out patterns for parts. It was occupied the southwest side of the building.
Each pattern was made of wood?
Well, yes, mostly. See, in those days you didn't go to a part store and buy parts. If you had a particular piece of machinery out here, say doing hay or doing threshing grain or whatever, if something went haywire, you didn't go to a parts shop and buy a part. Came to my dad's place and he made the parts. So they had quite an extensive, what they call a little casting area, and they made Babbitt bronze and various kinds of materials to make these parts.
Babbitt is an alloy, right?
Yeah. But I remember Babbitt and bronze and whatever else. I wasn't really into that all that much as a kid, but I used to stand there and watch them make these parts. But they had this...
Now the patterns for these parts, he must have gotten the pattern, pattern from the manufacturer.
I don't know where those parts came from. All I know was that it was in the building the first time it burned, and it was in a big safe. All the patterns were in this big safe, a fireproof safe, so they didn't lose those patterns. Mm-hmm. And at any rate, he did a lot of work. He repaired equipment as big as railroad engines, and these engines that used to bring the logs in that run these trains around here for the various lumber companies that transported their logs down to the mill here. For instance, the old camp up at is now Camp Elkana, but it was a Mount Emily camp that belonged to the Stang family. And then the Bowman Hicks lumber was here where the present fairgrounds are. And then there were mills in Union and Elgin. And my dad, I think he was, I may be wrong in this, but I think he was the only person that made the parts in that time. So that good equipment inside the building, it was a large building, and concrete floor, and everything was set up where it was convenient to the type of work that the different areas of the building was doing. And they had, Dad at one time bought a huge machine that was I thought it was huge, it was a big thing, and it ran off of the belts. They had a big central power system in the building, and then everything ran off a belt and pulley all over the building. And there was all kinds of drills, big drill outfits that they used. And then his machine, he bought sometime, after 1925. And it was a huge thing with big pulleys and wheels that turned on it, and what the idea was, to the person was going to cut off pieces of steel rod, they'd shove it in this one part of it and pull it and cut the rod off. Now they use entirely different materials to do for a rod. I suppose they just cut them off now for they're there, but back then that was quite a machine, and they got a lot of publicity on that fine machine that they could do all these things to cut angle iron and all that, to do away with the torches and the saws and all that. And that occupied a good sized area on the east side of the building. And then they did have a couple of forges there, that things that they could make, pieces that they could make and on a forge, and then however they milled it out or whatever they did after it.
Where did he find the trained workers for this kind of
machinery? Well, surprisingly enough, there were a lot of machinists around, very fine machinists, and they They probably worked for the railroad, or they might have worked for some of the mills or something, but eventually a lot, most of those people were working there because they found out after Dad got everything set up and everything was operating, they found out at the mill it was a lot easier to come and have him do it than it was to have all that, you know, try to make one piece or two pieces. And so in the name of efficiency, that became the place for almost everything that was done. Now at that time, right where the underpass between when you go out or come into LeGrand from Island City, where the underpass is, that was part of the land that Dad owned, and before that road went, highway went through there. And
was he paying fairly high wages to his workers?
Yes, for that time frame, they were some of the better paid men, and some, of course, depending on the machinists were well paid, and the people that did the pattern making there, they would take these patterns there, and I don't even know how they did it, but they would turn these pieces out if it was something that they needed, that they had papers for. They would just make them, you know, turn the lathes, and everything was, and some milling was done by the people who had the metal lathes, that's where your machinists came into it. They were pretty, very well versed in what they were doing, and it was amazing to watch some of the things they turned out. It was really quite a thing.
Was this a formally formed company with him as the president?
You mean who owned it?
Yeah.
My dad.
Yeah, but was it a company?
No.
A legal company?
Well, no, it wasn't incorporated. It was just LeGrand Ironworks, and that's it. Dad was the company, and then later on, my sister's husband graduated in civil engineering, I think around 1922 or long thereafter. He got back from World War I. He went, he was a very fine bookkeeper and a very efficient person, and just ideal for Dad, because after my brother-in-law, after he came into there, he kind of reorganized things and got everything business-like and running. I think Dad carried most of his business in his hip pocket in the early days, then it became more of a company, but it was never no stockholder. It was just Dad.
Yeah. You mentioned in the first interview that he built a number of the iron bridges around Union County.
Yes.
Tell me a little more about how that came to be and what these bridges looked like.
Well, the last bridge that Dad built, or not the last, but the last one that was still standing around here, on the old road out of LeGrand, if you went, went out, just if you're driving down Adams Avenue, you went to 2nd Street, turned right, and went over the viaduct over the railroad tracks, and made a sharp left right at the bottom of that, where 2nd Street went on north, and this road that you turned on, that was a highway out of town. So Dad it followed along the railroad tracks on the north side of the railroad track, and then turned right when it came to where Fox Hill comes down off the mountain. He built that bridge. It was an iron bridge. And
did it look like a railroad bridge?
Kind of.
We think of railroad bridges mostly as iron or
steel. Yeah, yeah.
Was that style?
Yeah, and you crossed the river right there.
Was that because concrete hadn't been developed to the point where they could make bridges?
Well, you'd call it a very primitive bridge based on present day. But you went out along whatever the name of that road that ran in parallel to the railroad tracks on the north side. When you made your turn to cross the river, all bridges had to cross at right angles in those days. There was no golden, no angle thing. So that bridge was made just the old iron bridges, of which there were lots of them all over every place, all over the valley at that time. And the first bit, as far as I know now, the first bridge that Dad ever was responsible for was that bridge that is what they call Oradale now, or used to call Oradale. But you crossed right over, and then after, right as you came off the bridge, then the highway extended on up the river then. But originally, you went up Fox Hill and up over and drifted across and dropped back down to the...
I'd like to know what the bridge looked like.
Well, it's just an iron bridge. All it was just barely wide enough, and nowadays you wouldn't even think it was wide enough for one car, I don't suppose. But it had a wooden deck, and there was some concrete on either end for footings to set it on. But at any rate,
did it have an arch?
Yes, it just I can see it in my own mind. It was probably like maybe 50 bridges around the valley or any place else in those days.
Was there a standard design that bridge builders like him were using?
Well, I think so. I believe probably were.
He didn't invent the design.
Oh, no. No, it was... the bridge was riveted in place. It didn't get transported and dropped. They built the thing right there on the spot, and it had the arch, and it had the cross things and the cross arms and all that. It looked just like a bridge, the old bridges.
Was it painted when it was finished?
Yeah, black. Matched Ford.
Yes. Yes.
And then later on, Dad, when you go up to Lower Perry, and the road, that was the highway in those days,
right.
And you went up through Lower Perry, and there was one or two bridges there. There was one bridge, if you were going west from LeGrand, and got to Lower Perry, you crossed one bridge. There was a metal bridge that Dad put in there, and then it took you over by the houses, some of the houses at Perry. Then it went over and turned to the right and crossed over the railroad tracks, and then went on up to the Grand Round River again, say about, maybe a mile and a half, 2 miles, I don't remember exactly what. There was another bridge there. Then you went across over onto the west and south. The road running to the west, and on the right hand would be the river and there. And anyway, there was a bridge then down there that crossed over there. Now, Dad, I don't think Dad built that, had anything to do with that bridge, because that crossed the railroad tracks and the river and so on.
Would I be right in thinking that these bridges were built strictly for automobiles and not for stagecoaches?
Well, I think so.
Stagecoaches used the dirt roads.
Yeah.
And didn't cross the river very often, I imagine.
Well, that's a little before my time.
I know.
Thank goodness. I don't know. I never knew of any. There was still a lot of stuff transported around the valley here and other places with horses and wagons. They didn't die out very easy because everybody had a lot of wagons, a lot of good horses. I think they used them until they just finally got replaced by mechanical things, but there was all over the valley where there were various kinds of bridges, most of which were not metal. There was just a couple of logging type equipment. They'd lay across the river and hammer some wood boards on it, and that was the bridge. But
who was paying for these bridges?
Well, I presume, I'm just a presumption on my part, I don't know whether it would be the county like that built this bridge that I set it across there at Ardell, whether those were county or state bridges or what they were. I know Dad, some of the bridges that he built, he sweat them out because they had a bad habit of water coming up and knocking them out every once in a while.
Flooding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that he ever had to replace any, but there's whatever, I remember that one, especially that one there at Ardell, why he just barely got the thing in and then they had high water, and obviously it didn't wash out. But that was one little memory I had, that he was quite relieved when it didn't.
You think most of those bridges were standing for perhaps a period of 25 years?
Oh, more than that. This bridge up here, I don't know when they cut what they call Ardell Boulevard now, which is the road that leads out of town now. That bridge was still standing when the freeways came through.
So up till the early 60s.
Yeah, and that thing was still used because the city dump was right there on the right-hand side of the bridge where you went across. Was right over here on the right-hand side. And in fact, they had a high school class out there digging up artifacts of the project and just a while back. But anyway, that bridge was there for a long time, even after the freeways came through. That, I don't know, obviously some reason for it. Somebody had to go over there, and you know, there was a reason to get on the other side of the river from right there, whether it had to do with the people with the irrigation ditches or not.
Yeah.
But whatever, that bridge was there from till, well, I'm going to say it probably wasn't taken out maybe till during, say, the 1950s.
So perhaps a 40-year life for most of them?
Well, I think, I would think so.
Yeah.
I'm just an assumption there because I know that all the different ones that were around the valley here, why they stood a lot longer and got used a lot longer than anybody thought they should have.
Do you have a photograph of any of them?
No. I believe there's some place that somebody took some pictures from Gangloff Park up there down toward that stretch of the railroad track. I believe there's one of those that you can see the bridge in.
Okay. Good. Now, you said stagecoaches were before your time, but in your first interview, you referred to the Hardings stagecoach.
Oh, yeah.
Well, where was that?
Well, if you... if you went to Hilgard and more or less followed where the railroad tracks, where they came into, like on Five Points Creek,
yep,
came up there, and then at Pelican Creek, I'm trying to say, where Pelican Creek was, which flows into the, just a little stream, flows into the Five Points, you turn left at the bottom of that hill where Pelican Creek comes down through, and essentially what it is now, to orient you to where it is, if you drive if you climb the hill after you pass Hilgard, it's over to the right of the freeway, and you climb that, make that long climb up to Spring Creek. If you where Spring Creek, where the bridges and things are that overpass thing, that gets you over the railroad tracks there at Spring Creek. And anyway, at that point, Pelican Creek head kind of goes down from there down to Five Points Creek. And if you were at Hillgard and wanted to go to where Harding's stagecoach stop was, you'd get on Pelican Creek and go up a ways, and then you went, later on when the railroad tracks came in, a railroad came through, they put one of those little cement things for the cars to drive under. But prior to that, that was just the old stagecoach road.
Did you ever see it? The stagecoach stop?
Yes.
What did it look like?
Well, it was just a very small building, painted red, and I don't recall what they may have done. Say, I don't know whether they changed horses or what. It didn't appear to be that way. It was just this stop that was on just on the right-hand side of the road, this little narrow Oregon Trail Road's all it was, and you went up there, and then you immediately after you went by Harding's, you had to make a left, and you went right up on a flat. But having said that, you got up on a flat all right, but getting from where the stagecoach was to the top to get out on that flat was another.
Yeah. You think it would have been a place where the passengers in the stagecoach could go to the outhouse and
I think, get a
drink or something?
Yeah, I think so. It's that type of thing. But
it wasn't an overnight stay.
No. Not that I don't know. I should say no real fast, but nothing that I knew anything about. But all I knew is that they had to make this left-hand turn just after you got past where the little old building was, and you had to climb right out, and it was picked out by hand.
You think that these stagecoach stops around here typically had a person who was in charge and stayed there?
Well, Harding's.
They made a business of it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. They had a little house nearby, maybe?
Well, I don't know about that. I've got a book in there someplace that tells about Christmas at their home. It goes into some detail about the Christmas at that place. But I take it that there must have been a home someplace around there, but it wasn't that red building. It was the stagecoach stop. And then after you got by there, you went up on this flat. Now that's where Harley Smith was raised. He's one of the old Smiths from the Valley Smiths out here. That Conley Smith Gray, and Miller. Harley was a Smith, and there's a log cabin up there. I'd love to go see that thing if it's still there. There's a log cabin up there, and I used to go up with him after my father passed away. Why, he was kind of like a second dad to me in a ways. And we used to go up there on weekends quite a lot during the summertime. And so that's the reason those memories are pretty keen. I was by that Harding place, but it wasn't fall down or anything. It still was red, but it was nondescript. We went by it, and unfortunately, I never paid much attention to it.
Let's talk for a bit about the Bowman Hicks Mill.
Yes.
The Union County Fairgrounds was. Were you ever inside it?
Well, not in. I was in the mill. Yeah, it was.
Did you work there?
Oh no. No, the only thing we ever. We were a bunch of honored little kids. Mostly we got run off the log pond because we got out there and run over logs a bit there. So that was my connection with the mill.
Did you know anybody who did work there?
Oh, I don't know. I'm sure there's a lot of people that did. I really don't know. The Ashby family owned or were in charge of or whatever, that mill. And it was a pretty good sized mill. It had a tall wooden water tower. And I'm sure there's pictures of it around town.
Yeah. I was just wondering about the inside, the working.
Well, I don't know. It was still. I think that mill. There's a picture in that. And Ashby's lived up in town on the corner of O Avenue and 3rd Street, I believe. And then when they closed the mill down here, I don't know whether somebody took over after they left or not, but I don't think so. I think they still had this mill. And if I recall correctly, I think the mill shut down during the Depression, but sometime somewhere in that time frame, Ashby moved up to Wallowa County and had that mill up there. And so I'm assuming it probably closed down just not because of a log shortage, just because of the Depression.
When it was in operation, did they have a steam whistle that blew at noon every day?
I don't know about that one. This one over here did.
Yes. Are there any other characteristics of the Bowman Hicks mill that you remember?
Well, that water tower, one of the reasons I remember is because Helen's uncle, Tex Knight, bought that old water tower. And he took it apart and had iron bands around it, which he unscrewed. And the tank itself was wood. And he bought it, took it over and stacked it up on a piece of ground he had, and was always going to put it back up, never did. So it ended up its days laying on the ground in Union. But I was not really around that mill that much because we were very good friends and well acquainted with the Stang family, and I've been through that mill a lot of times, but I never was over Bowman.
Do you think that the Bowman Hicks mill had its own source of power?
No, I don't think so.
Wouldn't they have had a steam boiler?
No, I don't. Well, I don't know. Let's see. Stang out here. So, based on that assumption, maybe that was powered the same way. I don't know. Stang had his own power, and that they had that for a long time.
Like a wood-fired boiler.
Well, I suppose. I don't think they bought coal to put in it.
I wouldn't think so.
Bowman Hicks was never a large, based on this operation over here, that was, a comparatively small mill. And, my memories of that, like I say, most of my memories of on a little dell to get out there and run on those logs, that was a big time sport.
Sure. I can imagine every boy would want to do that. Switching over to a couple of men you mentioned in the first interview, I noticed that when you talked about Spud Helm, you got kind of quavery in the voice.
Yeah.
Is he still someone that it's difficult to talk about?
Well, kind of. He's just like family to us, and
semi-pro baseball player.
Yes.
Where did he get on a team somewhere else?
Well, no, they had I don't know what this team was that was here. was made up of, well, Helen's uncle Tex Knight. He lived here in LeGrand at that time. He was on the team, and Spud, and
what's his real name?
Amos. Spud. Amos. Yeah.
How long had he been a policeman before he died?
Well, they hadn't formed the state police very long before Spud was killed.
He was a state trooper then?
Yes. I don't know a lot about the formation of the state police. See, everything prior to that time at the Gloria State Police Reform was in the county. Well, sheriff, and seems to me like there was some, city police. Now, Hap Dunn was a local person, born, raised here, but when he joined the state police early on, and he was he became the district, the captain in charge of the district, which is headquartered in Baker. And Spud was out of Baker at that particular time. And this was Hap, when he was a state or a city police officer, and he had a motorcycle. And this would be somewhere in the, when Hap was a state or city officer, that'd be, say, I'm going to guess now, but mid-20s. And one of the funny pieces about this whole story is with Hap, he was a city police officer in a motorcycle. My dad was a pretty obstinate man. He didn't like his mind changed by him or anybody else. And Dad had a habit of leaving the shop down here on Cove Avenue and getting in. He did everything same time every day that he did his routine. He would get in his Model T Ford and drive up to what was LeGrand National Bank, where Pioneer Bank is now. He'd make a U-turn and park in front of John Allen's cigar store, which is where that coffee shop thing is on the corner.
Highway 30?
Yeah, I guess that. Yeah. Is that it?
He'd make a U-turn on Adams Avenue.
Yeah, and he'd park his car. John has, yeah, well, that's part of the story.
Oh, okay.
John, he had a cigar store there. John Allen. Dad came up, turned around, went to do his banking, and he had cigars and stuff. Dad smoked cigars. And he parked there in front of there, and then they'd all get together and tell the biggest lie, I guess. But anyway, unbeknownst to anybody, I guess, the city passed an ordinance. It couldn't be a U-turn on these corners. Well, Hap comes, the police station was just over there where the fire station, present fire station, has a police station right there. So Hap comes over on his motorcycle and his uniform and puttees. And when Dad came out of there to get his car to go back to work, Hap said, "Dave, you can't park and do that anymore." Said, "Do what?" And he said, "Well, you can't make U-turns there anymore." And that ticked Dad pretty good. So he proceeded to tell John Hap where to get off. "I've been turning around there every damn day for on. And no young whippersnapper is going to tell me what I can do with my car." And he got in the car and drove off and left Hap standing there. And it made the paper at that time, I think. Hap was getting in trouble. The Duns were just another close family to us, you know. And the whole bunch of us all grew up together, all those Dunn kids, and the older ones were, but there was the younger ones were some of them my age, and then the older ones. But anyhow,
tell me then more about Joe Bob Price.
Well, when Dr. Gregory came, he was a doctor in Wallowa County, and he moved out here and took over the Hot Lake Hospital and hotel and holding out there.
That was after Mark died.
Yes. Well, that'd be right close to them, yeah. But when Dr. Gregory came out here, right where the truck stop is now, on Highway 30 right out here, he had a horse barn, real nice, and an arena and everything. And Joe Bob, Dr. Gregory hired him to be in charge of it. Joe Bob Price.
These to be show horses? Horses?
No, these were riding horses.
Yeah.
And I believe he came out here from Missouri or Kansas or someplace. But he was one of the top horse experts in the country.
Pardon? Training them?
Yes, training them, yeah. And he was a horse judge.
I do.
And he was just as good as they came. And he worked for Dr. Gregory for a long time. And then when Dr. Gregory, they had some kind of a set to or blow up or something about Hot Lake, and he left there and came to town, and he built a building right there where we're right across the street from the Methodist Church, and he had a clinic building there. And by that time, whether Dr. Gregory was getting older or whatever the reason, they got rid of the horses. And then Joe Bob, I don't recall what he did around here. He worked at the Elks Club at one time. I don't know if they ever sold cars or something. It seemed like, I just don't recall the different things he might have done. But he still continued to go out and help people with their horses and just people around here, and went out to judge horses at different, you know, horse shows or whatever it was. But he was a real Southern gentleman, the way I remember him. Just as pleasantest, nicest man I ever knew. And but that was comparatively short-lived. I mean, in the total time frame, I suppose the whole thing, from the time that building went up there, out there for the arena and all the show area and the whole thing, I don't suppose it probably occupied 10, 12 years. And but that's where Joe Bob came to this country. But he forgot more about horses than I ever knew in the first place, or, you know, just. Yeah.
Well, to elaborate on the Hot Lake affair, when Dr. Gregory took it over, was it on the way down?
No. No.
I understand that Mark Fly's management wasn't too good.
Well, yeah. I don't think we ought to talk about that.
Okay.
No.
I thought maybe that was the beginning of its decline.
Well, I think it declined in the idea that it didn't have the reputation that it had when the Fies were there. And Mark's dad, they had a huge dairy herd, and and they had chickens. That when you make that overpass, right after you go past Hot Lake and go over the overpass where that Barretto is now, why, that was a great big 2 or 3 story building to raise chickens. And so that was gone, and the dairy farm was gone. So it was declining to that there, but there was still a lot of medicine going on there. When Dr. Gregory decided to come out here from Lyle County, Jimmy Hahn was the doctor, and he came out with Dr. Gregory. When I say came out, I mean came out of Lyle County.
Yeah.
And Bill Allen ran the drugstore in Lyle. And he came out to basically, you might say, be the business manager of Hot Lake. And they had a nice restaurant there at the time. They had the old tile floor, I suppose ruined now, but had a beautiful tile floor in that main part of the building. And Bill, and then they had a pharmacy, which Bill ran. And Howard Allen was his son, and we went to school together. There, so I was in high school, and I don't recall whether Gregory made the move during that time frame. I said 1932, long in there, and that there. They had it built up to quite a good big operation, and Dr. Branner and Dr. Dr. Ross. He was the husband of Vina Conley of the Conley Farms out here. They were out there, and I don't know if there are any other dogs. I knew the four of them were there, and there may have been some others, I'm not sure, but that ran for quite some time.
Was it the Depression that did it in?
No, I don't think so. I don't know. I never did know. I don't know that Dr. Gregory ever owned that, the building and all that. This gets into old family stuff that I kind of hesitate to say what happened. I never did know what happened out there at Hot Lake. But all of a sudden, the doctors were involved there, and they just all quit, and that's when it went down. That's when it started down. And I have whatever my knowledge is of it, I can't verify any of this actually why it happened, except that there was, and I don't know how in the hell Mrs. Fye, and I don't know what she was. She wasn't WT's wife. I don't know what her connection, but her name was Fye, married name of Fye. And somehow or another, whether it came from the original Fyes, but as soon as she got a hold of it, that's when owners changed about every year, 2 years. And a Dr. Roth, he was not a medical doctor, Dr. Roth, R-O-T-H, he took over that. He had to start a nursing home there. And he was kind of a flighty guy, and we always used to say kind of screwy. But he was a good operator as far as that nursing home was concerned. And all of a sudden he was out of there after a number of years. He ran that, and everybody said he did a pretty good job for there. It was converted to a nursing home at that time. So that would be I can't peg down a name or a time for it. But I don't recall what happened to it during the war years. But Dr. Roth was, he was there, I think probably up to 40s to the early 50s, let's put it that way, it's about as good as I can do on it. And all of a sudden he was gone. And it's been that, has just been that, had been that for a long time. Everybody got a hold of it, got burned. And she always ended up holding the place. And it's still doing the same damn thing. She's dead now. But Hot Lake has been just a Jonah. For anybody that got connected with it, they tried all kinds of ideas to get money for it. And somebody asked me one time if I would like to put some money in Hot Lake, and I said, yeah, I sure as hell would. I've got a penny, and I want to drive by Hot Lake and throw it in. Now, that's as much as that's as much money as I'd put into Hot Lake. But everybody that got out there, including some very prominent people, stuck their money in that place, and they all lost it. And it down. And I had one of my most brilliant ideas. I said that what they should have done when they set off the bomb at Los Alamos to find out if it would work or not, they should have brought it out here instead and put it right in the bottom of Hot Lake and set that first atom bomb off. We'd have cleaned that mess up out of there. We'd deepened the lake. And it would all be gone. And if that had been done, there'd been about a half a dozen people that I know who lost their shirt in that place. Yeah. Wouldn't have lost their shirt. But Hot Lake is, they've had more fly-by-nighters, crooks or whatever you want to call them, that got in there and got money for this and that, and then took off.
Yeah. Well, it has a kind of mysterious glamour, I think, for many people, and they get the idea that it would be romantic and wonderful to somehow turn it into an attractive, money-making place.
Well, I had the best idea. See, I cleaned the land up, and then they could have got a hold of just the land. Yeah. They might have done that.
I think there are a few little impractical aspects to that, but we'll overlook that. That ends my list of subjects. Is there any other subject in your life experience here in Union County that we haven't talked about? I'm sure there are, but anything that you want to talk about?
Oh, I don't know unless you've got something you're curious about, because it seems like as many years we've all been here, we know too damn much about people around here that...
Well, I don't want to talk about...
No, but I mean different personalities that come here that... There's a lot of stuff, but different things that are going on. But I really don't have...
Okay. Let's end it there.
I can't talk about it. I've known so damn many of these people, and there's just best let sleeping dogs lie on a lot of these things.